This story is called The Unintended Legacy. A family dinner on a Sunday afternoon in July. Mario Brego was cooking barbecue on the gas grill, and his wife Anne was making conversation with her niece Barbara, while their daughters Tina and Celeste were adding finishing touches to the meal. Anne and Barbara smiled and fawned over Anne's two grandchildren who were running around the redwood table. The meal was noisy. Mario said that he liked to let his neighbors know when the Bregos were in their backyard. Anne said conversation aided the digestion. When people are quiet at the table, it's because they're uncomfortable, she said to Barbara, who nodded in agreement. Barbara Biamonte was accustomed to having dinner with the Bregos. She and her mother used to show up for coffee several times a week, and always for dinner on Sundays. Now that her mother was dead, she came alone. After Anne finished eating, she reached for a Chesterfield. Mario had turned the cellophane upside down on the pack again. He had done that to her several times a day now for as long as she could remember. It never ceased to annoy her. She saw him sitting there watching everyone eat and talk. He loved preparing for a good party and then taking a back seat while everyone had a good time. Almost as if he saw her, Mario called everyone's attention and stood to speak. Your mother and I want to share some of the good fortune that we've received. Celeste and Tina knew it was coming. They felt very proud. They had seen their mother and father struggle through such hard times, and it made this taste sweeter. As you know, I'm going to retire at the end of this month. I don't intend to stop working altogether, but it's the end of my full-time days as a driver. Well, to make a long story short, I got some money for them. Enough so that we can pay off our second mortgage, give each of our beautiful grandchildren something that will get them started someday, and go to Italy next summer. Anne chuckled at the look of surprise on the faces of her children. She hadn't told them about the trip to Italy. She and Mario had planned the trip so many times before that she had been too embarrassed to tell anyone that they were planning it again. Mario gave an envelope to each of his daughters and sat down. He shook his son-in-law Joey's hand and patted him on the shoulder. Joey grinned and put his head down. Joey was as close to his son that Mario could ever come, and the young man made him proud. Tina opened the envelope that was addressed to Joey Boy, squealed, and ran over to hug her mother and father. She hollered to Joey, "Look what my mother and father are giving the baby." It was $1,000. Celeste kissed her father and lingered with her mother. "That's going to help pay for her college," she said. They both regarded Angel with admiration. Her eyes were everywhere and looked as if they understood everything. Angel's stepfather didn't say anything. Mario stared thoughtfully at his new son-in-law. He had never really cared for teachers that much, but had figured that Celeste would go for one. Mario couldn't help but wonder if this marriage would last any longer than the last one. Finally, he came over and wanted to shake the newcomer's hand. Ron seemed uncomfortable with the gesture. Barbara waited until the daughters were finished before she offered her congratulations. Then they all drank coffee, and Barbara took out the pictures she had just gotten back from the developer. They had been in Italy in May. It was the first place she had really gone by herself since her mother died. She thought about her mother quietly and wished someone would have mentioned her. Sometimes they acted as if her mother had never lived. After everyone had gone home and Mario was settled in front of the TV set, Anne called her friends. "Mario promised that we are definitely going this time," she told Lucy DeMarco. "My grandchildren are beautiful and fresh. My daughters can take care of themselves. I'm sure that Mario will drive me nuts when he starts retirement, but so what?" It had been years since Anne had worked. The bad back that had gotten her disability had left her quite sedentary. But now she was into soap operas and talking on the phone dozens of times a day. She and Mario had made it to their 60s, and the hardest part was over. "Anne, who deserves this more than you?" said Lucy. "Lucy, I don't intend for this to be my only trip to Europe." They both laughed. Anne said, "I don't know what I'm thinking. I'll probably never get Mario to go anywhere after he does this." "Aren't they a bunch of old farts after they've stopped running around?" "And when they're running around, you're pissed off because they're not watching the TV." They laughed again. At 11 o'clock, she made her way downstairs to the living room. Mario was asleep on the floor. The guns from the TV were blasting over him. "The war is over for tonight, Mario. You better get a good night's sleep. Tomorrow is Monday." He went to the kitchen and drank some water. He went to bed without kissing her. She lit a Chesterfield and tried to get comfortable. At 5 foot tall and 200 pounds, she was only liked being on her side on the couch with the ashtray beneath her. Sinatra was on Channel 7 in The Detective. During the commercials, she could stare at the autographed picture of him that hung in her living room. In the middle of August, after dinner, while Anne was sitting at her dining room table, the phone rang. Mario answered it. Anne started to get up, assuming it was for her. Mario came back into the room and said, "That was Celeste. Tina and her and the rest will be over here in a few minutes." Anne was surprised. "They're all coming over here tonight? Are they bringing the kids?" Mario was on his way back to the TV. "That's what they said." Anne saw that her daughters looked tense when they arrived. They had all arrived together. Nobody was talking when they came in. She asked them what was wrong. "Dr. Avenal called, Ma," said Celeste. Anne's face dropped quickly. She looked around the table at them. "And?" "Well, they really don't know, but I've got cancer." "They found cancer in my chest x-ray, didn't they?" "Nobody is sure of that, Mom," said Tina. Celeste winced. "They think they saw a spot on your lung. Dr. Avenal is concerned. He knows how you are. It might not really be anything." "It might even be a shadow from one of the machines," said Tina. "Nobody said you've got cancer," hollered Mario. "They probably just want to take the x-ray over again." "They didn't all run over here because I've got to take an x-ray again, Mario," said Anne sharply. There was a painful ouch, and then the children started pushing each other. Tina hollered at her son. Celeste pulled Angel aside and told her she had to be a good girl because there was some adult business to talk about. Anne interrupted her and said she wanted Angel to sit on her lap. Angel cried to her grandmother that she was always getting the blame for things that Joey Boy started. Angel said, "Can I have some special Nana water to make me feel better?" "Of course you can, honey," said Anne. Joey Boy began to cry because he wanted some Nana water, too. Angel screamed that he couldn't have any because the Nana water was only for her. Anne told Angel that she had to be nice to her cousin. Angel twisted her mouth and said that if he was going to be allowed to drink the special Nana water, then she didn't want it ever again. Anne tried to take Angel into her arms, but the child pulled away and ran into the other room, where she hit Joey Boy on the head with her doll. Joey Boy cried, and Ron took Angel for a walk around the block. Angel stopped at the door and turned around to look at her grandmother. "I'm sorry that the doctor said you're sick, Nana." Celeste began to cry. Mario said there was nothing for Angel to worry her little head about. After Ron and Angel were out the door, Tina took Joey Boy into the other room and told them that she wanted him to tell Nana that he was sorry that the doctor said she was sick. Joey Boy said no, then laughed and ran away from his mother. By the end of the week, they were pretty sure that Anne had cancer. Celeste told her mother that she was moving her family into the house so that she could take care of her. Mario was in retirement, but he'd gotten a part-time job driving a delivery truck. He wasn't going to be around at least 3 days a week, and nobody expected him to provide the kind of care that Anne was going to need. Dr. Avenel was a good-looking, well-dressed man in his 30s. He loved Anne Brego. She had been his nurse when he was a little boy. He remembered her always as soft and warm. She made everything into a game for him. When she pricked his finger for blood or gave him a needle, he'd cry and she'd hold him and tell him how strong he was. She'd tell him how other little boys had to be held down to get their shots and that he was tough. It made him feel special. Anne was sitting in his office. Avenel thought it was a serious but early thing. She had a real chance. He needed a biopsy, and then he could start treatment. And just maybe, Tina and Celeste were sitting in Avenel's office with each other. Mario had to work. Dr. Avenel smiled and said hello to everyone. "Anne, I think you've got a pretty serious problem here," he began. Anne Brego nodded her head. "I'm not going to lie to you or soft soap this in any way." Anne nodded again. "In all probability, you have a tumor in your left lung. I'm not sure what kind of tumor it is, or how long it's been there. We need a biopsy for that. But I do believe we've got this thing in time. There's a real chance that treatment will be effective." Celeste looked a little startled by the last remarks. Her mother's breathing was getting worse by the day. Tina was smiling at Anne. Anne said, "How long do you think I've got?" "I don't think it's necessary at all to think in those terms," said Avenel. "I'd like you to start thinking about what you're going to have to do to get better." Anne stared at him without saying a word. She began to think, for some stupid reason, about Mario bringing a guitar to her house to serenade her from beneath her window on the night before they were married. She tried to remember the song he'd played over and over, but she couldn't. Celeste, Ron, and Angel moved in with Mario and Anne temporarily. The thought of having Angel around was almost enough to make Mario feel like there was a bright side for all of this. During the first days after the visit to Avenel's office, when she wasn't going for tests, Anne would sit at her kitchen table and think about Calabria. She had heard about the place all of her life, and all of the things she had heard. She at least deserved this trip. Her thoughts always came back to her when asking if she was still well enough to travel. The doctor said that it would be wrong to go away now. she had begun to feel so much weaker since the tests began. Seeing the doctor was a chancy proposition when something was really wrong. They hadn't really helped her back. They hadn't helped her allergies. They owed her this one. If they could do something now, all accounts would be square. During the war, she had nursed many people who were close to death. She would have sworn that she could always tell which ones would make it and which ones wouldn't. She couldn't have sworn anything about this case. Often, she would be carried through the soap time by the reveries. Bettina and Celeste would fill her in on what was taking place. Her children were so good to her. She knew that her feelings for them could not be better. Now Celeste was even there to help her. She felt stronger when her children were around. After a failed attempt as an outpatient, Anne was admitted to the hospital for another try at the biopsy. She was having a lot of trouble breathing. She was always weak. But the hospital was filled with her friends. Familiar faces came out to her from every department. The one-time kids that she had grown up with, her relatives through marriage. The night before her biopsy, she had dinner with Mario, Celeste, and Tina from the bed at her hospital. At first, everyone was tense, but she teased them, and they hugged in ways that she knew would make them calm. It was her smile and the feel of her arms. It was the feeling of that soft body, strong will, and knife sharpener's tongue belonged to all of them. Celeste kept telling her that the first thing she had to do when she came out of the surgery was to spit out the tube with which she had been intubated. Dr. Avenel had stressed the notion that the oxygen would make her breathing feel so much easier that she had to give it up as soon as possible. Celeste asked for the 50th time, "What's the first thing you're going to do when you wake up?" "Pull out the tube," said Anna. She looked at Tina and then back at Celeste. "I'm as proud of the two of you as I can be. You've both brought beautiful, precious grandchildren home to me. They make my home ring with life."
"It rings real good sometimes," said Mario, nodding his head emphatically. Everybody laughed. That was followed by quick, half-hidden tears. It was like they were splitting soft atoms of emotion. It went on that way for hours. Not so much memories as the reopening of circuits. Then the girls kissed her goodbye. She was very tired. Mario sat by the bed, holding her hand as she dozed. She watched them leave. The music that he had played for her that long time night ago came flooding back. Then it dissolved into Sinatra singing, "I'll Be Seeing You." They gave her Demerol early in the morning. Her friends had worked it out so that she wouldn't miss her morning coffee so much. It didn't work. Anne still wished that she had her coffee. Then they took her downstairs. They gave her a second shot to further calm her down and parked her in the hall outside of the operating room. Alone in the hall, Anne stopped breathing. It was the size of the tumor that was really in both of her lungs and had made its way through the rest of her respiratory system. It was her weight. It was the Demerol. One of the nurses finally saw her pallor and called for help. Immediately, Anne was coded. They put her on a respirator. She awoke in the intensive care unit and immediately tried to pull the tube out of her throat. They had to call her again. This time, they tied her hands down. During the time Anne lived on the machine, she saw all of them again. Angel was scared of the big machine that Nana was attached to. At first, Anne had been angry with Celeste
about the tube, but eventually she understood what had happened to her, and then she died. Anne Brigo's wake was large and emotional. Even Dr. Avenel came to pay his respects. Mostly, things were the way Anne would have wanted them. After the second night of the wake, Mario asked to have a conversation with Celeste and Ron. It took place after the people who had come to their house for coffee and sandwiches had left. Mario told Celeste and Ron that he wanted them to move into their house permanently. He told them that he didn't think he would be able to hold on to the house without their help. "I know how you feel about this place," said Ron. "It would be a crime to see you lose it." Celeste loved Ron more at that moment than she ever thought she could. On the day they were moving their furniture in, Mario said, "Now you know how niggers feel all the time." Angel said, "What's a nigger, Ron?" Ron's face went hard. His eyes glared. "I tried not to use words like that around children," said Ron. "In fact, I'd rather if she grew up without knowing what any of those words mean." "A nigger is a nigger," said Mario loudly. "My father is a racist asshole, too," said Ron. "The assholes are the ones who don't know what a nigger is," hollered Mario. Ron returned to Angel. "I don't know what a nigger is," he said. "You'll have to ask your grandfather. But just remember that what he tells you is the way people thought before they knew better." Mario tried to split his time between Tina's house and his own. He disliked the way Celeste cooked. She put fancy sauces on things that were better left plain. She cooked chicken all the time. If she served real meat two nights in a row, Ron would comment that they were eating too much beef. But there was Angel. She looked at him with a loving face. She had put her head on his stomach and her arms around him when he stretched out on the floor to watch TV. He did everything that he could think of doing for her. He hollered at his daughter when she was sharp with her. He gave her desserts when she wasn't supposed to have them. He let her watch TV in the middle of the night when she woke up. And he promised her the world forever. Some weeks after the funeral, the family gathered for the reading of Anne's will. Her son-in-law, Joey, was the executor of the estate, but he didn't want to read the will and gave it to Mario. It was read after Sunday dinner, during the time which they had left Anne's seat empty. Everyone who was mentioned was present. It began with the naming of several people to whom Anne bequeathed her undying friendship and a piece from her china closet. Barbara received all of her picture albums, with the exception of those special photos that Anne's daughters might want for themselves. Celeste and Tina were to have all of her personal belongings and half of whatever proceeds there might be from her estate to share between them. She left Mario the other half and the promise that if there was a next life, she would do everything she could for him from there. She told him it was because of their union that anything was left of her in this world. Everyone cried again. Mario continued, slipped, and called Celeste by Anne's name. First, the friends and cousins came forward. They kissed the paper where she'd signed her name and went to the china closet. There were sentimental treasures there, the wooden beer mug from Germany, the pictures of Sinatra, the ceramic Zodiac, the Demitasse set. No one dared
touch her crystal champagne glass, or the music that played I'll Be Seeing You while an elegantly dressed couple twirled under glass in the center of a globe. When they were finished, Mario said, I want you all to know that Anne and I have always been thankful for everything you brought to our home. Now this house belongs half to my daughters and half in trust with me for my grandchildren. I hope that all of you will still want to come here and be with us. We may be sad for a while, but for me anyway, I don't want to be left alone to mourn. Everyone hugged him and cried some more. Celeste and Tina served coffee. More memories and tears about the life and death of Anne Brego were shared. After the people had left, Mario stretched out on the floor and watched Von Ryan's Express until he fell asleep. It was after midnight when he woke up. He clicked off the TV and went to the kitchen for some water. In the quiet, he could hear Celeste crying from upstairs. He walked to the stairway and went halfway up. The crying had gotten softer. He heard her say, Ron, hold me. Come in me, so I don't feel so alone. He turned away just as she started to moan. His first feeling was anger. He wanted to go up and knock on the bedroom door. It was still his bedroom, even though he couldn't sleep there anymore. His hands trembled. He turned and went into the guest room downstairs. Mario began to keep the TV on all night. He spent more than half of his time with Tina and her family. Celeste was the same girl she'd always been, but Mario didn't think he could continue to put up with his son-in-law. He didn't do anything the way it was supposed to be done, and he was unsociable. He couldn't make conversation with someone who always had his nose in a book. Most of all, he didn't pay the proper respect that a man was due in his own house. Tina had been listening to her father complain about Ron's strange ways for as long as she could stand to keep quiet. Ron was now insisting that Angel be punished when she had a tantrum. Anne would turn over in her grave at the sight of Angel slouched against the door of her room, letting loose with pitiful howls. Joey said, Ron thinks that you can do everything the way it is written in a book. Mario and Tina laughed at the remark. Joey Boy had been listening and said, I don't like them books. They all laughed again. Tell that to your Uncle Ron, said Tina. That Sunday, they all had dinner together. They were having roasted chicken. Tina went out and brought steaks for her husband, her son, and her father. She was going to cook them on the gas grill in the backyard, even if it was December. If her sister didn't like it, that was just too damn bad. Ron was in the basement, supposedly correcting papers when they arrived. He didn't come up to say hello or to play with the children. When the food was ready, Celeste saw Tina going out the back door with the steak. She understood what was going on immediately. She did not object for the sake of keeping peace, but she felt Tina had stuck it to her. We're waiting for the steaks to cook, said Tina. Is Ron angry with us for some reason? Celeste could see that this did not have the makings of a pleasant afternoon. He's just busy. His grades are due tomorrow. It's Sunday. We always forget the jobs on Sunday. Ron's not like that. Celeste was beginning to feel defensive and felt relieved when she saw Ron coming up from the basement. Tina said, I'm sure, and went back outside for the steaks. Then it was time to eat. As soon as Joey Boy spied Ron, he ran up to him with a look of urgency. "Uncle Ron! Uncle Ron!" He was almost too excited to get it out. "I don't like them books, Uncle Ron."
"What books?" said Ron.
Mario, Tina, and Joey began to laugh. Joey Boy was encouraged by his success. "I don't like them books, Uncle Ron."
Then a big smile came over Joey Boy's face. He slapped the table with his palm and said,
"I hate them books, Uncle Ron."
Mario, Tina, and Joey laughed harder. Celeste wasn't sure what was funny, but she laughed too, because she was glad at least everybody looked happy.
"I don't get it," said Angel.
"Never mind, honey," said Mario.
"But what books is he talking about? He finally says something that I can understand, and it doesn't make any sense."
"Don't get smart," said Celeste sharply. Angel looked at her mother with huge, disbelieving eyes.
"You always take his part, don't you? Never my part."
She ran away, crying, from the table.
Mario hollered at Celeste. "What did you have to say anything to her for?"
"She'll get over it," said Celeste.
Mario threw down his fork and went to get Angel. He coaxed her back to the table. She sat with her arms folded and her back to the table. Tina tried to convince her to turn around. Mario told her that her mother was sorry for what she had done. Angel wouldn't budge. Finally, Ron got up and walked around in front of Angel. He said quietly, "Either turn around and eat your food nicely, or leave the table." Angel ran out of the room crying that no one loved her and that everyone thought she was always wrong. Mario threw down his fork again.
"What did you do that for?" he said to Ron. "We were just getting her calmed down."
Celeste hollered, "It's not his fault, Dad."
Mario turned red and screamed, "Shut up. This is all your fault. The way you pick on that child, it's a wonder she acts up the way she does."
"What do I do to her, Dad? Do I beat her? Do I take things away from her? She's 4 years old. What do you expect from her?"
"These are her carefree years, and you're ruining them for her."
"I don't think that's true, Daddy," said Tina.